Good afternoon, Bill Hoag here.
Hi, this is Willie Pritchard.
Hey, Willie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, sure, happy to.
Willie, we usually start by giving people an opportunity to just say, how'd you get here? Remember that our target audience, presumably here, is people who will be in the next generations coming forward who have aspirations to continue to develop their career, perhaps as far as becoming a CIO. And we're looking in particular to provide a context for those folks by having you talk about how you managed to end up as Vice Chancellor and CTO at Foothill De Anza.
Well, it's been a long, strange trip,
as
you might imagine. I was an undergraduate in the 60s, so the long, strange trip seems to be quite an appropriate metaphor for how I got here.
That's a line from the band, isn't it?
That's right, the Grateful Dead. But I initially didn't even think of computing as any part of my future career when I was an undergraduate. During those times, everything related to technology seemed a little bit anti-humanitarian, if you will. So my decision after college was to become a VISTA volunteer and try to work to help others. And growing out of that, I decided I needed to work in the area of education to try to make a change in our society. Once I got involved in that, I actually was a secondary school teacher for about 6 years and a dropout prevention center counselor. And while I was there, I discovered computing when I found out that there was a Plato lab in my high school that was probably doing a better job of keeping students in school than I was. The students that I was working with had actually flunked the test that they needed to pass in order to get their diploma. And they would come to me and tell me what a wonderful and exciting tool this was and how, in effect, I understood it to be playful for them. So when I went to check out this computer lab that was in a math classroom, which was alien territory for me, I sat down and immediately was entranced by it and determined at that time that I really wanted to learn more about this. And knowing hardly anything, I embarked on this journey to try to teach myself a little bit about technology and soon decided I needed to go to graduate school to learn more specifically about computers and technology. I did that by going to the College of Education at the University of Florida, where I essentially had to carve out my own program because the entire college virtually had little understanding of why I was even there. Nonetheless, I persevered, and my first job after that was at Vassar College, where I went there on a FIPSI grant to promote what was then in the early 80s known as computer literacy, which nowadays seems somewhat archaic to think about. The computer literacy program was designed to try to incorporate technology into the liberal arts, and it turned out to be a very enlightening experience for me, and I found that that was, in fact, my passion. However, there were some personal events that interceded, and I took a second job about 6 years later at the University of South Florida. I had grown up in Florida, and family was there and so forth, and I took a job in the College of Engineering doing in an R&D center called the Center for Interactive Technologies Applications and Research, where we did fundamental research on computer-based training courses as well as intelligent computer-assisted instruction and so forth. It was all on soft money, so at that end of that time, at the end of the 80s, there was a bit of a recession. Much of our funding was based on funding from Westinghouse, and they made a corporate decision to cut off our funding, so I needed to look for something else to do. And there was a local community college that was undergoing an intense effort to educate its faculty and put computers on the desks of all faculty offices. And I moved there to become director of instructional computing. The person who hired me there moved on to another job. I saw that things needed to change for myself, and within a few years moved to the Houston Community College system in Texas, where I was assistant vice chancellor for instructional computing, doing much the same kind of work, supporting faculty in their use of technology. And subsequent to that, I then became dean of technology at De Anza College in Cupertino, California, here in the Silicon Valley. And when services were consolidated to centralize technology support throughout the district, it's a two-college community college district, they created a position of vice chancellor for technology. I applied for that job and got it, and for the last 6 years I've been playing that role. So that's the long, strange journey that I've been on. I feel like I've learned a lot, and I hope to be able to share what I've learned through the process of this conversation.
Good, good. You mentioned early on in your description that you had the proverbial aha moment when you sat down at a Plato terminal.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other aha moments during your career when a light bulb has gone on and you've said, I now understand what I need to do next? What I'm getting at really is sometimes I laughingly describe my own career as the accidental career. I don't consider myself a good model of intentional planning and execution of the plan. What has compelled you, if there is anything that you can point to make some of the moves that you've made?
Well, I'd say that in much the same way as you described, there's been a lot of serendipity in the progression of my career. Clearly, the initial aha moment was the most powerful one for me when I saw the Plato online learning activities. It just got me charged so much I could hardly sit still.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately decided that I needed to start devoting more of my life to that kind of really the use of technology to help people, which up until that time had seemed somewhat of an alien concept to me. And I guess there are really only, as I look back on it, maybe two other aha moments, and they probably are shared by many of others in technology of my generation. One was when I had an opportunity to see the Macintosh before it was actually released. At that time, I was at Vassar College, and we were doing this endeavor to put computers on everybody's desktop, so word had gotten out that we were looking for the right kind of technology to do that, and I was very fortuitously flown to California along with a couple of my colleagues from Vassar to see the Macintosh in about 1983, about a year before it was released, and seeing the graphical user interface, seeing the way in which we can move away from a command line interface and into something that seemed much more humanistic, much more human-oriented, was just an eye-opener for me and helped really to rededicate me to working with technology to help people. And then, of course, another major aha moment, I'm sure for many of us, was the realization of the practical uses of the web, being able to bring essentially the world's knowledge and information to fingertips of almost everybody. And that was another very exciting moment for me, and it helped further confirm for me that there is and was for me a very positive motivation in moving with technology to help others in their learning and understanding of the world.
I see by your peer directory profile that you are now or have been a member of the Apple University Executive Forum. Obviously, your roots go deep, at least 23 years back, according to my quick calculation,
mm-hmm.
to when you had that non-disclosure look at the early Macintosh. And yet you're also on the Microsoft Higher Education Advisory Group. One of the questions that we try to get at in these conversations is, how does a technology leader maintain balance and regardless of what one's personal preferences might be for personal technology, try to put that aside and lead as appropriate for the institution? Any insights in that direction?
Well, I think it relies on a basic principle and philosophy that you have a job and you do what is best for the institution, not always in congruence with what maybe your personal beliefs are. The reality of the specific situation with the Macintosh and Windows is that there just aren't the applications available for the Mac that there are, especially at the enterprise level, that there are in the Windows environment. And being paid to do a job means that sometimes you need to make decisions, or not just sometimes, but probably quite frequently, you make decisions that are in the best interest of the institution, even though you wish that there may be some other alternatives or choices that you could make. So my role in being on these advisory boards really is to help those companies recognize ways in which they could provide better products, whether it's Microsoft or Apple, for higher education. And being an advocate for higher education really serves that greater goal and purpose of providing what's best for your institution.
In terms of the other sorts of things that you've seen and learned in your career and the kind of the fast-moving evolution of technology, how much today this is kind of an aside question, but I think based on what you said, it's very important. How much today do you get into the issues about open source or not, and how much do you bring to the table of that working with these companies?
Well, excuse me. Open source is one of the new movements that I guess, and to a certain degree, is an aha moment as well, but to a lesser degree than the ones that I mentioned. Being a CIO of a community college, we're much more restricted in our resources and our ability to provide the kinds of technology that other institutions are. And open source provides an alternative for us to be able to bring technologies in that are more affordable for us than going with a strict commercial line. We are an active member in the Sakai organization and, in fact, a developing partner for Sakai. And we also have strong support from our board. One board member in particular is very keen on moving forward with open source as well as open courseware. And so it's a general philosophy within the institution that we need to be examining all alternatives that provide the best cost for results ratio that we can. At the same time, I recognize that open source is still very limited in the market and isn't as fully robust as many commercial applications. So there's a constant trade-off between the evangelism, if you will, of a board member and what makes practical good sense for the institution from an enterprise point of view.
As you've gone along in your career, Willie, are there people that you would point to at various stages of your career who served as significant mentors for you?
There have been individuals who've helped give me encouragement and sort of like a cheerleader role. When I think of a mentor, I think of somebody who's providing guidance and advice and counsel about what directions to go. I can't say that I've really had someone who's served that role for me. But there have been people who've really been influencers who've encouraged me and supported me in the decisions I've made. But I wouldn't say they guided or advised me in the classical sense of a mentor. I think when I first had my first aha moment with the Plato experience in high school, I did have an individual who was the vice principal of the high school, who was very supportive of my exploring a field that was somewhat counter to what my assigned job role was, and in fact encouraged me to go to graduate school and move out of the environment. I suppose, probably looking back on it, if it hadn't been for him, I may still be a secondary school teacher to this day, and wouldn't have gotten into technology at all, or at least I wouldn't have had a clear direction on how to move in that way. So I have had coaches and cheerleaders or something like that, but I wouldn't exactly say they've mentored me in the classic sense of the word.
Do you see yourself acting in that role for people that you have worked with over the years, either in the informal sense as you described it, or more formally where you pay sort of a bit closer and more intentional attention to people's development?
Well, I'd like to think that I've been a mentor to some people. I know that our profession really needs skilled, motivated, and talented young people to move up in the field. There have been several very talented folks who've worked for me or that I've worked with that I've tried to provide advice, consultation, and help to them, and stay in close contact with them. I've had, as I indicated earlier, a number of different jobs with a number of different people in different institutions, and I try to stay in contact with them and let them know that I'm willing and able to help them as they move through their career. I think it's really critical in our profession as we look at the baby boomer generation moving on, and as the world becomes increasingly more complex, the technology world as well as the world around us, that we have a way to nurture future leaders. And so I do try to provide that kind of advice and consultation to those folks that I've had contact with. It's also really personally very rewarding to see folks that you've worked with and tried to provide help to see them become successful in their careers as well. So there's a little bit of a personal ego stroking in that as well.
As best I'm able to piece together your peer directory profile and the conversation that we've had thus far today, you've spent time in the Southeast studying at Duke. You've spent time in Illinois. You've spent time in upstate New York at Vassar. You've been in Florida. You've been in Texas.
Pretty itinerant lifestyle.
California. Sure.
Right.
I'm envious. You weren't following the Grateful Dead around, were you?
Well, no. Although when I finally got to California, where they seem to have made their origins, Jerry Garcia passed away shortly after I got here. So
bad luck.
Yeah, no, I don't think I was actually following their path, but I did follow, I guess, opportunities that arose that became open to me, mm-hmm. and often it was a mixture of an opportunity and a desire for a change, and it just happened, at least from my perspective, it worked out well for me. It also has provided me with a really deeper understanding of the differences, different kinds of people that make up our country. Living in the South as a youngster and going to school in North Carolina, and living in New York. I lived in New York City for a while when I was a VISTA volunteer out of college. That was quite a change for me. And then to spend a few years in Texas, it just helped me to understand more about the fundamental human nature of everybody, that we all have common goals and aspirations, and that there are times when it may appear on the surface because somebody is stereotyped as a cowboy from Texas or a redneck from North Carolina or an urban sophisticate from New York, we all fundamentally are the same.
You really anticipated a number of my questions about the role of geographic movements or movement from institution to institution. One of the points that I really credit David for making in the chapter that we've written is that sometimes people need to be prepared to move and need to be prepared to change institutions and even parts of the country. And there are pluses and minuses in both directions, and you've obviously named a number of the pluses. If you were advising the next generation, as we hope we are, about what to think about and how best to prepare when contemplating the possibility of moving from one institution to the other, whether it's across town in the same metropolitan area or across country. Any particular gotchas or things to be aware of as you evaluate that kind of decision?
I would say that when you start to recognize that things aren't, that you're not comfortable, that's when you should start going, well, then maybe there's another opportunity. At the same time, you need to make sure that the other opportunity is one that you will be comfortable in. And it's a delicate trade-off, if you will, between that and knowing that you also have to provide sustenance for your family, and recognizing that what makes you happy will make your family happy. And so it hasn't always been easy decisions, and there's always been a strong pull just to stay and see things through. And even though this sort of sounds like there's been difficult times at each of the institutions I was at, I don't think that's necessarily the case. Reflecting back on it, I think there was just a desire on my part to either learn more about another environment or to experience something new and different that I could make an impact at.
I was just thinking that you just touched on an issue that when we make, as I have too, and as David has too, decisions to move from one institution to the other, it isn't always because we feel that we're at the end of the line in a particular institution, or that there are insurmountable frustrations or obstacles or something like that. Sometimes we hope that more often than not it's you depart for very positive reasons rather than departing for negative reasons.
Right. Yeah.
But at the same time, in your own role now as the Vice Chancellor for Technology in your current institution, you've been in that role for a number of years. No doubt, on a regular basis, if you're a CIO just like all the rest of us, you face your share of disappointments and frustrations and have to navigate turbulent water now and then. What advice could you offer to the next generation about how one in a leadership position manages to navigate those turbulent waters and maintain balance and a positive leadership role?
Well, being a CIO is a really complex job. You've got executive management responsibilities and insights into the enterprise and its operations, and there's some real challenges that come with that. I think probably many people, both inside and outside of technology, expect the CIO to know everything there is to know about technology. It's always surprising to me how many people come up and ask me relatively trivial things. How can you help me with this? This problem I'm having with my PC or whatever. It's finding the balance between your role as an executive and senior manager in the institution and your desire to help people, and what's the best way for them to be able to be helped by not only you, but also by the organization that you manage. And it's extremely challenging. The other thing for me personally has been, it's been very challenging in a community college district after my experiences in other institutions where we have lack of resources to be able to do all that our institution would like us to be able to do. And the challenges can become quite overwhelming at times, where you're trying to make decisions based on the ability to provide a certain service but not be able to provide other kinds of services or resources because you just don't have what it takes to be able to deliver. And so the complexity of the job is compounded by the political needs to provide base level service, yet also balance off what the desires are for many in the institution to move forward either more quickly or more dynamically or whatever. And I'm sure this is true at almost any institution, because one thing about technology is that it inspires people to see what's possible and what's potential, what can be done to improve the situation. And I'm sure every CIO faces that challenge. I just know for me personally, it's been extremely challenging to do that in a environment where the resources aren't what many of us in this institution would like it to be.
Sometimes timing is everything. You've been in California during some of its most turbulent budget times in its history.
Yes, most recently. It's also, I got here in 95, right before the dot-com run-up. Mm-hmm. And so I think some of that, the hangover from that is still with us. There's still the belief that, well, we can do anything we want to do, particularly here in Silicon Valley. And there's that culture of that. But at the same time, shortly after the bust, it actually took a couple of years for that to hit the community colleges here, because it takes a while for the funding or the lack of funding to work its way through the tax system, the state political system, and end up in reality for us. So it has been quite challenging to see both the boom and the bust within, let's say, I've been here just a little over 10 years now.
At a personal level, do you do anything in particular that you would be willing to share that helps you to maintain the balance you need to be an effective leader?
I probably don't do enough. I try to exercise as much as possible. I think good physical activity is a way to cleanse the soul as well as keep the body in shape. I try to keep outside interests as a part of what I do, although I think sometimes that's been hurt more than I would like it to be. I think there's keeping a work-life balance is a real challenge, probably for anybody in technology, but particularly CIOs. It's just is extremely challenging to avoid, especially with the advent of technology, where you have wireless in your home and a laptop almost glued to your body, to be able to set it aside and say, no, I'm just not going to pay attention to that right now. I need to take care of either myself or my family or my general mental health.
Mm-hmm. David, you were going to follow up a bit.
Yeah, I had a question from earlier when you were talking about knowing when to leave. How much do you trust I don't want to ask a closed-end question. I'm just asking you to kind of reflect on this, Will, if it's okay. But how much of that is intuitive or gut, and what role does that play in your reasoning?
Well, looking back on it, I think that probably it has played a pretty big role for me. My background as a counselor, when I got out of college and then was in the secondary schools, has me probably more aware than others about what's going on in my head while I'm thinking about what decisions to make, as well as what's happening emotionally and viscerally with what I'm doing. And so when I look at making changes in jobs or in my career, I'm pretty much tuned into what my feelings are about it as much as what any analytical process I may be going through to determine it. And I think so far I've been fairly lucky in that the emotional, visceral feelings that encourage me to make changes have worked out pretty well. I guess I fundamentally believe that if you're not happy in what you're doing, or you think you could be even happier, then that's the time when you should be thinking about making a change.
would you say after the number of years that you have had leadership roles that you've seen an evolution in the kind of competencies required for leadership?
You know, at one level, there's the fundamental understanding that, at least from my perspective, that the principles for good leadership don't really change. Yet, at a different level, we see new philosophies, new books, new strategies for providing that leadership come out over, let's see, this has been about 30 years now. Every year there's a new bestseller book on how to be a good manager. And fundamental to that, at least from my perspective, there's just a few basic principles that you need to understand if you're going to be a leader or a manager of other people. And they come down to things like respecting other people, not just the people that you're working for, but the people who work with you. Make sure they understand that you have respect for them and their abilities and their understandings and their take on life. I think there's also a need to be flexible, particularly in technology, where the technology is changing constantly, and every so often there's a new product out that promises to bring great and wonderful new things, and you need to be flexible not only in terms from a technical point of view, but also in your interactions with people. And so flexibility of as a key principle and philosophy can help serve you in times when things seem to be a little bit stressed or a little bit tight. I already talked about having a life outside of work. In order to be a good leader, you've got to have time to take care of yourself and be able to get away from it and take some time to reflect in a way that's not in the hustle and bustle of the job. And taking care of yourself and having other outside interests gives your mind time to rest and be able to be fresh and refreshed when you get back to focusing on your work. I think another thing about technology is that you've got to be prepared to deal with and dealing with people too is be prepared to deal with ambiguity and uncertainty. You don't know what new technology is coming, or you don't know what strange reaction some person's going to have to something you've said or done. And so you'll be surprised, and hopefully the surprises are good surprises, but they aren't always. And so the nature of technology and the nature of people is that you're going to be surprised. And don't take surprise as something that's unplanned that you've got to come up with a plan for immediately. Take time to reflect on that surprise and why it happened the way it was and how you can react to it. So there are some basic things like that I think don't change really over the years, at least in my years in this business. Those things are still fundamental principles that have lasted through the years that I've been in this, and I think probably will continue to be.
I was going to ask that last piece as my follow-up question. If you telescope ahead 20 years down the line as best we can see it, imagine it, think about what our IT environments might look like, would you say then that you see those core leadership competencies as still holding true 20 years hence?
Well, the principles that I outlined are basic and fundamental, from my perspective anyway, to human nature. And it takes a lot to change human nature. It's difficult difficult to project out 20 or more years into the future. It was interesting. It just occurred to me that back when I was in graduate school, I wrote an article that was published projecting what instructional computing would look like in 2001, and I just had reason to pull it out not too long ago. And it was sort of humorous to see how simplistically I viewed the world then. But at the same time, there were certain elements of it that rang true. And I guess one of the challenges when you look into the future is figuring out which ones you're going to laugh about later, and which ones are the ones that are really going to happen. And I guess that gets back to the fact that you need to be prepared for the ambiguity of what's about to happen, and go with the flow seems somewhat trite, but being able to make adjustments accordingly gets back to the basic principle I said before, being flexible.
I'd like to go back for just a second to an earlier observation that you made, that you have worked successfully in both elite environments such as Vassar, for example, and you certainly have a lot of familiarity at places like the University of South Florida, for example, with institutions that are adding programs and growing and trying to build reputation and expanding the reach of or the comprehensive nature of their education. And yet ultimately you turned to the community college sector and have for a number of years. Could you reflect a little bit, keeping in mind advice for others who may be interested in learning from your experience on what caused you to go into that sector of higher education, and what maybe some of the pluses and minuses would be of any of those sectors that you've worked in?
Yeah, I feel lucky, actually, to have been able to have experienced the range of higher educational institutions that I have. It really has provided me with a deeper understanding of what each institution's role is in our society, and what some of the challenges are that they face, as well as what their goals and aspirations are. And in that regard, I feel very lucky. Reflecting back on how I made those changes, they really seemed at the time to be the right decision for me at the time. It wasn't that I said, well, now I'm going to go experience this new environment. There was a combination of circumstances and events that led me to think that either I needed to make a change, or this was a change that was going to be better for me or for my family. And each institution really has been personally rewarding for me, as well as I can see that you made reference to, I think what you were getting at was the role of each institution within our society. And it's interesting to look at that. I really feel strongly and passionately now about the importance of community colleges, after having had experience in both an elite institution and what we call I think you made a reference to a growing university and a more of a regional university. I've always been motivated by the desire to make the world a better place for people, and the desire to get into education was part of that. But I see community college's role as really being critical to the health of our society, as well as to the health of the people who work there and who attend community colleges. It's a critical role for us as we look at our society, and particularly in recent years with some of the national politics that's taking place, the importance of the service worker and having an educated workforce is just vitally important for our country and for our society, I think ultimately for the world. And there are just so many people who desire to learn and understand their world, yet don't always have the resources to do it the way that some of us have been so fortunate to be able to do. Really is so important, I think, to not only our world, but to myself. I mentioned that I went to Antioch as a graduate student, and the first president of Antioch was Horace Mann, and he is known for a saying that has really stuck with me. Be ashamed to die until you have some victory for humanity. And that's a role that community colleges really play, is really helping so many people learn so much more and be able to become successful. That, you know, I think many people might look at my career and go, oh, geez, he was at Vassar College and had an opportunity to really be a part of the elite higher education. And I did get that role, and I did play that. But fundamentally, I think it's really important to go where there are people who are really in need and you can have an impact on in a very positive way.
You've mentioned a couple of times during our conversation what's good for your family and the role of family in some of your career decisions. To the extent that you feel comfortable in sharing any information about it, one of the issues that any of us who relocate in particular face is how to work in the best interests of our families. And I wonder if you have any insights, having done it a couple of times at least, about some of the factors that have gone into your decisions.
The decisions to move haven't always been solely my decision, I guess. There's been some desire to make a change. In one case, my wife had just finished getting her graduate degree and didn't see an opportunity where we were for her to be able to take full use of that. And so she played a factor in making the decision to make a change. So that was part of it. We have one daughter who was growing up through most of these changes. She was born while we were at Vassar, so she was still fairly young when I made some of my early career changes. But we made a promise to her when we came to California that we weren't going to move again until she graduated from high school at the very least. And fortunately, neither one of us felt a desire or a need to make a change. So in many ways, the familial decisions were joint decisions that were for the whole family, as opposed to just me deciding, well, I need to make a change.
Good. David, did you have follow-ups? We're not too.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions, I guess. What do you see as some of the most essential characteristics or qualities that a leader has to have, and why? You know, just two or three of the things that you say, okay, this is absolutely required.
Some of them I've already touched upon. You have to pay attention to people and respect, show that you respect them, not just the people that you're providing support or serving, but also the people who serve you and who work for you. You need to listen to them. You need to show them respect. You need to get to know them on a personal level, if at all possible. Understand, if you can, what their desires and their motivations are, what makes them happy, what makes them unhappy. You can't, fundamentally, I don't think you can be effective if you're not paying attention to people. Too often I think we get tied up in technology, and there is this belief that you have to make technology decisions as a CIO, and fundamentally they're people decisions. 95% of the time, because as a CIO, you're really working at a level where you're not as deeply involved in the technology decisions. You have to rely on your staff to provide you with the technical underpinnings of recommending certain decisions and so forth. I think I've touched on a couple others. You have to be flexible to be a leader. You've got to be able to understand that if you're dogmatic in your approach, you're going to run up against opposition. And, well, even if you're not dogmatic, you're going to have people who don't agree with what you're doing. And so work for a flexible solution that you can compromise on and that will help you to be successful as well as to help others see what they're getting out of it as being successful too. So go for the win-win solution. You can't be successful if you win and they lose, because ultimately it comes back to bite you. And it's just, it's better to find ways in which you can compromise and help others to reach their goals at the same time.
When you are looking at potential leaders to mentor or to move into places of responsibility within your organization, are those the same sorts of things that you're looking for, or are they separate, or are there others?
Yeah, you know, I don't know how many people I've hired over the years. I've hired many, many people. And one would think that you should be looking for the technical skills above all else. But fundamentally, I think if you find somebody who has an inquisitive mind, who shows that they have care for people, and that they desirous of providing a service-oriented mentality, that the technology part of it they can learn if they don't have all the skills. Obviously, in some cases, you need to have certain minimal skills in the technology area to be to make a hire like that. But if I have the trade-off, I've got somebody who's technically expert but not much of a people person, or not doesn't seem to be inclined to want to learn on the job, and compare that against somebody who may be a little bit deficient with their technical skills, but have an eagerness and to not only learn but also to be a service provider, I'm going to go with that person almost every time.
One of the things that's characteristic of your career is that you have an exemplary role, if I may say so, or an exemplary record of service in a variety of things, new media, Sachs, the EDUCAUSE in various roles. I've already mentioned your advisory board work for corporations. What can you say to people who will be following us into our roles in the years ahead about the value of networking and how best to make use of those kinds of activities to expand your horizons?
Well, first, I've been very lucky in that I've worked at institutions that support that. And that's one of the things you should always be looking for if you're making a career change, is will the institution support you in your efforts to learn more about your profession as well as to have some influence on that profession? And so that's very important in the decision process. But I think personally it's let me start over and say that institutionally, if the institution doesn't understand that, then that's not an opportunity for you to grow in. And if an institution doesn't understand that, then they don't understand that your activities in those areas will come back to help that institution in many more ways than the hours or time that you spend playing those roles. So now, from a personal point of view, it has been extremely rewarding for me. I find that I've gotten much more in return for the activities I've done along those lines than anything, any of the hours that I've put into it, because I'm constantly learning new things, meeting new people, getting a better understanding of the world of higher education, of technology within higher ed, and the rewards for being a part of all those activities far outweighed the hours that I spent doing work for those institutions or attending meetings or whatever. It just has been phenomenally rewarding for me to take part in those. And I think a lot of it has to do with the people who also were involved in those. They also were highly motivated by their desire to either improve the profession or make education a better place for people as well as for technology.
Last question that I have, Willie, and David may want to have one more as well. when you think about your own career development, both in the past and as you go forward, as your career continues, are there any particular titles, authors, books, pamphlets, poems, pieces of fiction, periodicals, and so forth, that you would recommend that people become familiar with or that have at least been important to you?
It's more an accumulation of things rather than anything specific. I was fortunate early in my career to have been involved in loosely called the human potential movement. I did a lot of reading as a when I was in graduate school at Antioch and studying to become a teacher. I did a lot of reading with and it was very popular in that time in the early 70s. And it basically just gave me an understanding that people are primary, and that respect and understanding for what people's motivations are, and a general faith in the belief of the potential of humans to of people to learn more and to do good has really impacted me more than any particular management philosophy. I have been involved in the Educause Management Institutes, and there's, if I were to recommend one thing to upcoming technology people in higher education, there is it's such a rich activity to participate in, to go away for a few days and take part in those institutes has been I just see change happening in front of my eyes when I work with people who are aspiring or seem to be on a path to be in technology management, to go to those institutes and participate in those activities. And it really is an inoculation, if you will, into a variety of different ways to see how to manage technology in higher education. And personally, I was speaking earlier about how rewarded I am. I find that I do that 2 weeks out of every year, and I need to, because of my position, to take vacation time to do it. I find that it's as stimulating and rewarding to me as many other vacations I've taken, even though I'm working the whole time. So that's what I would recommend.
Have you, if you, let me think of the best way to say this, or ask this rather. If you were leaving, based on, or everything you've said notwithstanding, maybe that's the best way to say it.
Okay.
If you were passing someone coming into your office as you were leaving, and they were taking over your operation, and you could only pass them and just had, you know, 30 seconds to a minute with them before they took over your operation. This is just hypothetically, for whatever reason.
Right.
And they looked at you and said, Willie, what is the one thing, just one thing that you would tell me, whatever you do, don't forget this. What is the one thing that you would say to them is the one thing not to forget?
Wow, I don't know if I could distill it down to one thing. That's a challenge. That's probably the most challenging question that I've heard today.
It wasn't meant to be that. Just a, you know, it's just one of those, we all kind of struggle for those little kernels and crystals and things that we try to hold on to and keep in our minds.
Uh-huh.
That's the reason for the question.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Ah, geez. I guess it would be, and this seems to be a continuing theme of what I've said all through this hour or so, is that, you know, have respect for other people and understand that, and help them to understand that what you're doing is what you think is best for the institution.
Very
and
good.
I run.
Very good.
Yes.
Willie, we thank you. Before we sign off, I want to give you an opportunity to throw in anything that you think we should have asked that we failed to ask.
No, I can't really think of anything right now. I think it's been a pretty comprehensive. I do appreciate the fact that you sent me some of the questions ahead of time so I can have some time to reflect on. Often in this job, you don't get an opportunity to reflect particularly on your career and how that might influence and help others. So I do appreciate your providing that to me ahead of time.
Terrific. Well,
it has been a true pleasure to talk to you today.
Yes, I've enjoyed the conversation too, and look forward to meeting you face to face at some point.
Excellent.
Absolutely.